Good evening, everyone. Thank you for coming out to St John's College on such a horrible wet day. It's really nice to see you here. Welcome to the college and to this evening talk as part of our programme of events today as part of the Festival of Ideas. For those of you who haven't already seen the exhibition in the Old Library of College, that's going to be open for about an hour after the talk, so you can come along and see some of the items that you'll be hearing about in the talk and some other interesting items from our collections. We have two very esteemed speakers tonight, Dr. James Harmer of St John's College and Dr. Ian Patterson of Queen's College, Cambridge. They're going to each give a paper of about 20 minutes, and after that there'll be time for questions to the speakers, and also if you have any other questions about the college library, its holdings, anything like that, then I'll see if I can answer those. So, without any further ado, our first speaker is Dr. James Harmer, who is a research fellow at St John's College. His interests are in early modern English, in language and linguistic creativity in particular in that period. Tonight he's going to be talking about a manuscript of Thomas Sackville, which is the Duke of Buckingham's Complaint. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Katie, and good evening to everyone. I'm going to be talking about a longish poem that was written in the 16th century by someone called Thomas Sackville, and the title of the poem is The Complaint of the Duke of Buckingham. So first of all, who was Thomas Sackville, the author of this poem? Well, Thomas Sackville was born in 1536, and he was the son of a lawyer and MP. He probably went to Oxford or Cambridge as the first stage of his higher education, though we don't know for sure. But we do know that he qualified as a lawyer in 1555. And at around the same time, he got married to a woman called Cicely Baker. And their union was to be extraordinarily successful and long-lived. They stayed married for 53 years. Sackville ends up writing about his wife in his will with tremendous affection. So by the time he's in his 20s, Sackville's pretty well set up for a promising career in public service. And by the time he gets into his early 30s, he's managed to get elected as a Member of Parliament, and he's become a courtier known to Queen Elizabeth I. In 1566, Sackville seems to run into some trouble when he tries to negotiate one of Elizabeth's many proposed marriages. She never showed much appetite for any of them. But interestingly, he comes through this difficult process with an increased reputation. And for something like another 40 years, he serves Elizabeth I and then James I as a privy councillor, an administrator, and a valued courtier. The hallmark of Sackville's long career, it seems to me, and perhaps a chief reason for it being so long, is his desire to make people behave reasonably and sensibly. The ultimate moderate, he staunchly supported Elizabeth's moderate religious settlement in the 1570s, which on the whole discouraged the persecution of Catholics and the radical forms of Protestantism that were becoming ever more popular in other parts of Europe. Sackville spent a lot of time in his middle age, during the 1580s, trying to keep the military ambitions of English noblemen in check and avoid mounting tension with England's continental neighbours. In particular, he acts as a kind of brake on the personal and military ambition of Elizabeth's favourite, Robert Dudley, Earl of Leicester. And in a funny way, it's wonderfully fitting, I think, that Sackville actually slumped over and died at King James I's council table in 1608, worn out in the service of the crown. So that's a brief overview of Sackville's life and career, but what about his literary activities? It's in the early part of his life that Sackville spends time writing poetry and drama. He co-wrote a very important play titled Gorboduc with Thomas Norton, another lawyer at the Inner Temple, and it was performed at the Inner Temple over the Christmas season in 1561 to 62. The titular character in Gorboduc is a king in ancient Britain, and the play is about the civil war that results from a divided succession. Gorboduc's the first play in English to be written in blank verse, which is the ten-syllable, unrhymed line that closely approximates the rhythms of normal speech, and it becomes the staple form of Elizabethan drama. And Gorboduc's also a very early and important example of an English drama that's influenced by the themes and style of classical tragedy. We get the blood-curdling curses, the complaints to the heavens, and the acts of treachery that populate plays written by Roman dramatists. So Gorboduc, which is probably Sackville's first literary effort, is an important source of ideas and literary style for later writers. Most notably, Shakespeare's King Lear draws on several features we find in Gorboduc. So Sackville was interested in writing that explored political conflict and psychological trauma. Both of these aspects of life were very real to Elizabethans living in the 1560s. On the one hand, the still unmarried queen suggested the possibility of a contemporary succession crisis, mirroring the one we get in Gorboduc. And on the other hand, deep divisions remained in religious life between Catholics and Protestants, and also amongst different factions of Protestantism. So the very purpose of human life and the nature of its God-given guarantees were a matter of desperate difficulty for lots of people. It's these problems, how to steer a course politically, ethically, spiritually, how to lead a good life of sound moral judgment, that Sackville explores in his other major literary work, and that's The Complaint of Henry, Duke of Buckingham, the manuscript you can see in the library here at John's. So, what is The Complaint about? As the poem opens, we find ourselves in the company of a narrator, also called Sackville. He's out wandering in windswept fields. Night has fallen, and cold stars have come out, and in this dreamlike, almost magical place, Sackville has a reverie or vision. My busy mind presented unto me such fall of peers as in this realm had be, he says. So the subject of the poem is going to be the fall of the great, the peers or noblemen of the realm. At this point, the figure of Sorrow appears to Sackville, the narrator, and she leads him into a wood where he comes across a hideous hole, all vast, cloaked with the pestilent savours that arise. This hole is the gateway to the underworld. Sackville the poet is giving his narrator a vision of the place occupied by the dead, a kind of hell, but one that the narrator can enter and understand, as he does in epic works like the Aeneid by the Roman poet Virgil and in Dante's Inferno. In fact, Sackville's gateway to the underworld is very much as the Roman poet Virgil described it in the Aeneid. The Romans thought the entrance to the underworld was at Lake Avernus in southern Italy, and you can still go and have a look today. So we get the sense right from the start that this is going to be a poem about speaking to the dead, to the past, and seeing what can be learnt by doing so. When Sackville starts to go down into the hole, he sees a whole range of allegorical figures that make it clear to him that he's going to be told about human pride, ambition, arrogance, and failure. He sees figures like revenge, dread, malady, and famine. Famine's forever trying to sate her hunger by gnawing on her own bones, and she gnashes her teeth as the narrator Sackville walks past. Then Sackville sees great men who are now quite literally reduced to passing shadows of their former selves. Hannibal, Julius Caesar, Pompey Magnus, and finally the Trojan king Priam. At this moment, just as he's seen Priam, Sackville sees another figure appearing in the gloom, and it's Henry, 2nd Duke of Buckingham. Henry was born in 1455 and pitched straight away into the Wars of the Roses, the English Civil War between the rival royal houses of Lancaster and York that dominates the 15th century. Henry became Duke when he was just 4 years old and later married the sister of the Queen of England. He became a close ally of the Yorkist king, Edward IV, but in 1475, at the age of 20, Buckingham and Edward had some kind of serious falling out, probably related to Edward's attempt to launch an invasion of France. And after this date, Buckingham becomes ever more estranged from the king and strikes up a close relationship with Richard, Duke of Gloucester, soon to be the infamous Richard III. There are dark rumours in contemporary accounts that it was Buckingham who agreed to plan the murder of the princes in the Tower, Edward IV's two sons, to clear Richard's path to the throne. But as soon as Richard became king, a Lancastrian conspiracy to overthrow him was set in motion, and several thoughts seem to have gone through Buckingham's mind at this point. Buckingham himself had a distant claim to the throne, so could he come through the melee and claim the prize himself? On the other hand, would the Lancastrian rebellion succeed, leaving him at risk of imprisonment or exile or death? Whatever his particular motives, Buckingham was persuaded to join the rebellion. One of those doing the persuading was Margaret Beaufort, the founder of this college, mother of the future Henry VII and grandmother of Henry VIII. Buckingham goes to the Welsh Marches, a traditional stronghold of the would-be Tudor dynasty, and he tries to raise an army there on behalf of the Duke of Richmond, who goes on to become Henry VII. But he couldn't do it. In the face of poor weather, resentful and deserting troops, and an approaching task force which is sent by Richard III against him, Buckingham throws in the towel and he throws himself on Richard III's mercy. Deemed too dangerous to live, Richard had him executed in November 1483. So it seems to me that Buckingham's life is quite gloriously melodramatic, full of murderous political intrigue, crises of loyalty, and at times, comic ineptitude. He's somewhere between The Godfather and Blackadder, I think. Most notable, perhaps, is the instability in Buckingham's character. His impulsive break from Edward IV, his quick change of allegiance from Richard III to the would-be Tudor king, and this trait of instability is at the heart of Sackville's treatment of Buckingham in this poem. Sackville makes it clear that when he became an ally of Richard III, Buckingham was getting caught up in the moment. In Sackville's poem, Buckingham knows that it was a dubious decision to side with Richard, but seeing the state ravaged as it was by civil war, he says that it wasn't merely personal ambition that drove Buckingham on, but Richard's apparent strength, his ability to convince Buckingham that he could provide stable rule. "Myself not bent so much for to aspire as to fulfil that greedy Duke's desire." When Buckingham's complaint turns to the murder of the two princes in the Tower, Sackville leaves us, unlike the historical record, in no doubt that he was directly involved in the planning of the killings. Yet Buckingham dehumanises himself as he describes to Sackville his knowledge of the murders in such a way that it makes it clear he knows he wasn't thinking rationally. He and his fellow conspirators were like to the wolf with greedy looks that leapeth into the snare to feed on deadly food. So as it's framed in the poem, the murderers were persuaded to think that the conflict between the rival claimants to the throne could be ended by their hand, since the boy king in the Tower wasn't strong enough to act as ruler in his own right, and only Richard could provide the decisive leadership the country needed. But Buckingham now sees that this desire to make an end of conflict was a delusion, that a desire for praise and power had infected his judgment, and that he, just like Richard, had in fact become greedy. What's worse, the act of murder, what was meant to draw a line under the Wars of the Roses, is only the beginning of Buckingham's personal war with his own psyche. He becomes terribly paranoid, as he tells Sackville, in fear of wreck at every blast of wind. Sackville takes great pains in the middle of the poem to dramatise Buckingham's psychological suffering, his terrible guilt, and he buttresses our sympathy by making it clear that Richard was going to blow the whistle on Buckingham as the prince's murderer. Again, here's Sackville making a clear decision about something that's not so clear in the historical record in order to help point his poem in a certain moral direction. The aim, if we were to sum it up, is to be careful what you wish for if you go into politics. Buckingham protests that one moment of madness, the fateful decision to help Richard claim the throne, to be a kingmaker, proved the catalyst for a never-ending stream of disastrous decisions and irrational behaviour, his involvement in plots, his lack of loyalty, and finally his death. And Buckingham's death is spectacularly relived in the poem. This is one of the poem's real literary high points. The manner of Buckingham's death mirrors the manner of his life. All of a sudden, in front of Sackville, he starts to writhe about in agony, and then he goes pale, and then he turns bright red, and then he subsides and turns pale again, and then red, switching several times between the different colours of the royal houses of York, symbolised by a white rose, and Lancaster, symbolised by a red rose. Sackville's poem was published in The Mirror for Magistrates, which is a compilation of texts designed to offer examples of bad political and ethical decisions. There are two editions of this, and Sackville's poem appears in the second edition of 1563. The text as a whole was enormously popular throughout the 16th century. The overall aim for Sackville is to show those in positions of power how not to behave. And the manuscript of the poem that we have in John's was probably largely written by Sackville himself in his hand. Other hands, though, come in and annotate bits of the text. It's quite common in this period to present a manuscript of something you're writing to friends or colleagues so that they can look at it and discuss it in private. The areas of the poem that are most heavily annotated in the manuscript are just those descriptions of famous people, often Greek and Roman figures whom Sackville encounters on his journey down into the underworld, who somehow fell from grace, who were stabbed in the back, lost the battle they should have won, or had their judgment dulled by greed. It's clear from these early readers that Sackville's poem was understood to point the way to the kind of prudent action that would let you avoid these fates. And Sackville himself, I suppose, husband, courtier, and counsellor for half a century, did better than most in aspiring to stability and moderation and acting as rationally and prudently as he thought he could. This poem shows how, in any kind of political life, you need to tread an incredibly fine line with the Godfather on one side and Edmund Blackadder on the other. But that there is some kind of ethical and political code of conduct that is something to be aspired to and something to be followed. Sackville's poem teaches us the value of moderation. It teaches us the value of a life in politics that's as ethically aware as it can be. So this is a difficult idea for us in the modern world, but one that we can still get a great deal of insight into by looking at texts written some 450 years ago. Thank you very much indeed. Thank you.
Thank you, James. Our second speaker tonight is Dr. Ian Paterson of Queen's College, where he teaches English and is also the librarian. He asked me to say in his previous life he used to be a bookseller as well, so he's particularly well qualified, I think, to speak tonight on the subject of T.S. Eliot, the Hogarth Press, and poetry publishing. Thank you, Ian.
Thank you very much. I want to talk about Eliot in his early years in England. I want to talk about the making of a poetic reputation in relation to the small number of poems he wrote and the small number of books that he had published between 1917 and 1925. By the time he published his first, as it were, collected poems in 1925, he was really quite a well-established figure in English and American poetry and criticism and literary journalism. And he carried his name carried quite a lot of weight. It is really quite extraordinary in some ways that in such a short period of time, such a relatively young person should have got to this position. And one of the ways in which we can understand how it happened, I think, is by looking quite carefully at how he managed his reputation and how and what he published and where he published. The first poems he published were in the Harvard Advocate, a magazine of Harvard students, where he was an undergraduate student, a graduate student, and then a teaching associate, teaching assistant. He left in 1914 and came to England, or to Germany and then to England. And he was associated with the magazine quite closely when he started to publish in it, and he became its editor, and so he could control what it was that he printed of his own, where it appeared, and how it looked, and so on. And I think this early experience, student experience of publishing his poems, was one which he stuck to as a sort of principle, as far as he could, through the rest of his writing and publishing life. When he came to London, he didn't know very many people. He didn't have very much in the way of published poetry behind him, apart from the poems in the Harvard Advocate and one or two other places. He had a certain amount of ambition, quite a lot of ambition. He knew what he didn't want to do, which is he didn't want to be an academic. Partly coming to England was a way of escaping being an academic. He knew he wanted to be a poet, but he was by no means certain that he ought to be a poet or that he had the equipment to be a poet. He was also quite concerned that he ought to have enough money to live on, and he knew that being a poet was quite likely not to bring that in. So as he was a philosophy PhD, or was about to be a philosophy PhD, he thought, not unreasonably, that philosophy and the sort of things that might be associated with philosophy outside academic life, a kind of literary journalism, a kind of commentating role, might be where he, and teaching in adult education classes, extension classes and the like, might be where he would put his energies. But in fact, quite quickly, he got a job working in a bank, sorting out securities and such like in an underground room where he spent his days. So he was already not a typical poet for that time. He was not like Ezra Pound or many of the people associated later with the Hogarth Press or at that time with the Bloomsbury Group, because he was at work all day and most of them weren't, either because they didn't need to because they had money or because they didn't want to because they could get enough money from here or there just about to scrape by. Eliot liked work. It's an important thing about Eliot. He also quite liked people to work at his poems. His poems are not, and certainly were not then, easy of access. And so they were not widely read. They were not widely read, and they weren't likely to be widely read. And this also affected the way in which he thought about their publication. Between his arrival in London in 1914 and the publication of his first book in 1917, he wrote very little. Most of the stuff that he had written, he had written before he came. Not all of it, but much of it. Prufrock, for example, one of the poems for which he is still best known, the love song of J. Alfred Prufrock, was first written in 1911 and finished in 1912, published in Poetry Chicago in 1914 and not published in book form until 1917. He made a little go a very long way. He thought about it for a long time. and he was not expecting to have enormous public acclaim straight away. Between 1914 and 1925, he publishes 7 books or pamphlets. 3 of them, are prose works. There's a little pamphlet, really, that was called Ezra Pound, His Metric and Poetry, which was published in New York without any author's name appended to it in 1916 1917, I think. It's just 30 pages, and it went along with their printing of Pound's book of poems, Lustra. And they obviously thought that they could sell this on the back of that, or sell the 2 for 1, or on Amazon it would say people who looked at this probably bought this as well. And so the American publisher was prepared to print this, also because they knew that Ezra Pound was a difficult poet, and to have a little bit of explanation might help the sales along. By 1917, in fact from 1916, Eliot had taken on a part-time job as for £9 a quarter as editor, for assistant editor of the Egoist magazine, which was a magazine which had been devoted primarily to women's suffrage questions, but which Pound had got hold of and twisted the back end into a poetry magazine. And he then slid Eliot, who had become his friend and protege, into the position of assistant editor. And Eliot had to write quite a lot to justify this position, but he also could publish his poems there. And in 1917, it was the Egoist Press, a small press which didn't publish very much, which published his first book of poems, Prufrock and Other Observations. And this is a slender volume. It was published in 500 copies. It's only 40 pages. It's in wrappers. It's very fragile. But one interesting thing that one can learn from looking at copies of this book is that it was published in 1917 at a shilling. In 1918, it was on sale for 2 shillings, and then briefly for 2 and 6. In 1919, it was still at 2 and 6 until it went up to 5 shillings. It stayed at 5 shillings until late 1920, when the publishers got Eliot to sign the last remaining copies, and they were sold for 10 and 6. So in the space of 4 years, the book goes up by a factor of 10 in price. And this is an indication of something important that happens to Eliot and his reputation over those 3 years. These are the 3 years in which he publishes 3 books, not counting the one published in New York. He publishes Prufrock and Other Observations, then he publishes Poems, which is the first book he publishes with the Hogarth Press, and the 4th book that the Hogarth Press themselves publish. And he also publishes Ara Vos Prek, a much more sumptuous production altogether, but still very amateur, which is printed by his not exactly friend, John Rodker, a poet and translator and publisher and printer, amateur printer, who is keen to produce fine editions of good poetry. And he starts off his Ovid Press with Eliot's Ara Vos Prek. So these are the books that precede the publication of The Wasteland, and on which Eliot's reputation rests until The Wasteland is published, first of all, in magazine form in the first issue of The Criterion in 1922, reprinted the next month in America in The Dial, then reprinted in first book form in England in by the Hogarth Press, well, by America just first, and then in the Hogarth Press. So it hits the bookstands very rapidly in 2 countries in 2 formats. So people who bought the poem in the Criterion will probably want to go and buy the book from the Hogarth Press as well. I'm running ahead of myself because I want to say a couple of things about the Hogarth Press and Eliot and the way in which they parallel each other. The Hogarth Press is set up by Leonard and Virginia Woolf in 1917, where they think it might be fun to produce a few little books, mostly for friends, do a bit of circulation, make a little bit of money, on a hand press. So they have to teach themselves how to print on a hand press, which those of you who've done it know is a slow, messy, and difficult business. And they print, first of all, a little book by Virginia Woolf, and then a little, which is just one story. Then they print a story by Catherine Mansfield. Then they print a little volume of Sidney Woolf's poems. Sidney Woolf was Leonard Woolf's brother, who was killed in the First War. And then their first book, Eliot's Poems, which is just called Poems. So the press is primarily interested in doing very short books because they can't do more. They haven't got the resources. They haven't yet got the expertise. It takes a long time to set up the type and so on. It's quite amateurishly printed. There are quite a lot of mistakes. The pages aren't always aligned properly. They're bound in wallpaper quite often, or amateurly marbled paper once they get going, and either sewn or occasionally wire-stitched or stapled, and sold pretty cheaply, mostly among friends, in small editions. So the 1919 edition, Eliot's Poems, is sold in 250 copies, probably less, probably fewer. That was the largest number that could have been, but as nobody's quite managed to account for all 250. The other books were published in very small editions. They have things like 23 pages, 26 pages, 14 pages, 10 pages, 16 pages. It's not until the 10th book they publish, which is a volume by Gorky, which sells in the thousands, that they start to make any money. And that book, they don't print themselves. It's beyond their capacities. With that book, they start to outsource some of their printing. The Pelican Press printed that book. And they just did a bit of binding and sticking on the paper labels. And that, of course, is, on the whole, what publishers do. Publishers don't actually print books, usually. And Hogarth Press's journey towards being a commercial publisher is a journey away from the hand press into entrepreneurial publishing of the usual sort. But for some years, they carry on doing some of their own books, occasionally printing them actually themselves. It's good kind of therapy for Virginia Woolf, and it's kind of quite fun. And they have other people helping them by then. Why does Virginia Woolf, having set up this press, get to publish Eliot so quickly when the other three books are herself, her husband's dead brother, and her second closest friend at the time? How did Eliot get to know her? It's well known, it's a well-known feature of modernist studies, as we might think of it, that Ezra Pound and Wyndham Lewis, with whom Eliot was primarily associated, were very disdainful of Bloomsbury writers, of Virginia Woolf in particular, and devoted a certain amount of time to attacking Virginia Woolf and to attacking Bloomsbury as a phenomenon and to deriding a certain snobbishness and superficiality and cultishness about their productions, both in art and in writing. So how did Eliot manage to be friends and protege of Pound and a close friend of Lewis and printed and published by John Rodker, who is also another one of that group, and at the same time a close friend of Virginia Woolf's? Well, he starts off being a friend, and then she's not so sure about him. And then they get closer. I'll come back to that in a sec, too. It's because when he was a graduate student at Harvard, Bertrand Russell came and taught a course, and Eliot made sure that he made an impression on Russell, partly as an example of the kind of thing that American students are like, which we don't really have in England, which we don't entirely approve of, a way of wanting to be to show off a bit and to make unpredictable observations. But he clearly wanted to make an impression, and when he came to England, it's to Russell that he turns first, and Russell gets him some philosophy reviewing and helps him get some evening class teaching and that sort of thing, helps him in various other ways, and introduces him to Ottoline Morell, who has at Garsington Manor a famous house party every weekend where Bloomsbury people, Oxford people, First World War pacifists, painters and writers are regularly to be found, and where Eliot begins to be an occasional visitor. He's a very shy man, very diffident man, very buttoned up, very controlled, and Virginia Woolf does not at first take to him. When he first comes and she first meets him, she describes him as a polished, cultivated, elaborate young American, talking so slow that each word seems to have special finish allotted it. But beneath the surface, it's fairly evident that he's very intellectual, intolerant, with strong views of his own, and a poetic creed. I'm sorry to say that this sets up Ezra Pound as a great poet. So she already has doubts about his friendships, his friends, his associates. Then she says, not long after that, "Today we finished printing Eliot's poems, our best work so far by a long way, owing to the quality of the ink. Fewer blots." It's not high-quality printing, the Hogarth Press, in its early days. Then Eliot comes to dinner a little later. "I amused myself by seeing how sharp, narrow, and how much of a stick Eliot has come to be since he took to disliking me." She's quite sharp herself. And she also says that when Eliot's poems first appear, there is a very hostile review in the TLS, and she doesn't know why they are so up on their high horse about it. Yet, that's in 1918. He first meets her in November 1918, goes to dinner with her. He rather scrapes acquaintance. He sort of gets himself invited through Mary Hutchinson, who has a St. John's connection, I should say, though not a direct one. Then a few months later, the spring of the next year, she says, "I think one could probably become very intimate with Eliot because of our damn self-conscious susceptibility. But I plunge more than he does. Perhaps I could learn him to be a frog." She's quite whimsical sometimes. And then she starts getting involved with the Criterion, because by 1922 he's starting that, and she is now familiar enough with him to want to publish The Wasteland, which we're coming towards now, finally. The Wasteland is the book with which, as I say, Eliot makes his name, mostly through its magazine publication, which is very carefully orchestrated in America by Pound. A lot of preparatory work is done. The ground is laid, and he carefully works on people so as to make sure that the big prize, the Dial Poetry Prize, is awarded to Eliot, which is an enormous sum of money and a lot of prestige and a lot of publicity. So this is the poem by a poet that nobody's ever heard of that has won this big prize. It's published in the first issue of the Criterion, which is, again, a new, serious, monthly, or quarterly at first, magazine that has had a lot of pre-publicity, 500 copies printed, and is going to be the new, serious, intellectual, arty, literary magazine in England starting in 1922. And it has this new poem which people have been hearing about, and some people have been privileged to hear a reading of, or bits of, in the very first issue. Then he delivers it to Leonard and Virginia for publication in Britain, and they print it themselves, mostly. It's they're really their first proper hardback book they've made themselves. It's paper-covered boards with blue and white marbled paper. It's printed on not very expensive paper. It's rather gets foxed these days very easily. It's got too much acidity in it. But it works, and it's fairly level, the printing. But as in the American publication, it's the wrong number of pages. The poem would leave too many blank pages at the end, so they repeat what the American publisher did and print notes which Eliot was hastily asked to write at the end of the poem, which I think Eliot was quite well aware of what he was doing when he wrote these. It's another way of making the poem attractive to an audience. It's a novelty. It's a poem with explanatory notes. All this modern art, we don't understand it. Ah, poem with explanatory notes. Is this a trick, or is it something? Eliot was always rather self-deprecating about these notes, but I think there's quite a lot to be said for them. And so this book, fragile but more solid than the first book that's put out by the Hogarth Press, more long-lasting than the Egoist Press book, not as long-lasting as Aravos Prek put out, some of it done in vellum and bound in Morocco, the Rodker one, and mostly bound in black cloth. Easy to find, the Aravos Prek, if you can afford it. But now, if you want to buy these first four books by Eliot, it'll set you back altogether, about £22,000 if you're lucky. His prices have gone on going up since they moved from a shilling to 10 and 6. And they've even gone on going up since I was able to have some of these books. I used to have a copy of The Wasteland, which I bought in David's, actually, for £100. And I sold for not very much more. And I just, in interest, before I came here this evening, I Googled and Abe booked The Wasteland, and you can buy a reasonable copy for £5,000, and a very nice one for £10,000. It's a very expensive little book. Eliot is also aware, when he writes, that this is going to happen. He's aware of the virtues of coterie publishing. He's aware of the virtues of publishing in a small number of issues. His relatively small output, printed in relatively small books over a relatively small amount of time, paralleled by relatively small books put out by the Hogarth Press in relatively small editions, for over the same period of time, he starts publishing as the Hogarth Press starts existing. It's quite fitting then that the book that sets the seal on his reputation and marks his move into the public sphere as editor and founder of the Criterion magazine should be published by Leonard and Virginia Woolf at the Hogarth Press. These two march hand in hand, as Eliot and Virginia Woolf rather uneasily also nearly do from time to time in real life. The Hogarth Press goes on to be a commercial, relatively commercial press, one very popular with writers because it doesn't employ editors, and so their texts are pretty much printed as they send them to the publisher, which is a great boon. Doesn't publish an awful lot of poetry, but it never stops publishing poetry. Eliot himself is then thenceforth completely associated with Faber, who he which is a press that she's invited to join in 1925, and which publishes his work thereafter in various formats, from the little aerial poems, a series of illustrated poems that he organises and runs, through to the conventional Faber books that we're familiar with today, though they're not so nice now as they used to be. And he becomes the authoritative figure, the cultural mandarin that he set out to be. And it's through these this little 5 years of careful preparation, not allowing himself to be published in the wrong sort of anthologies. People were several times asking him for poems to be put in anthologies. Edith Sitwell wanted to publish him in her magazine Wheels. No, he didn't like the company. He didn't stand out enough. He wanted to retain control, as he did when he was editor of the Harvard Advocate, over where he placed his work, what happened. So it was never an accident that Eliot became the person that he is today, if he is a person. He set out, really, despite his diffidence, to achieve a position of cultural authority. He organized his friends to publish his work in a very carefully orchestrated way, and he moved, when he was ready, into a position where he could exploit it and become a cultural pundit of the sort that he was born to be. That's enough. That'll do. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Ian. Those were two really very interesting papers. I have a few questions ready, but I'm hoping someone else will leap in with something from the audience. No? Hushed silence. Okay, so I was interested by the point about Eliot wanting to be obscure, wanting to be difficult, and thinking about that in comparison with the Sackville, which we today find quite, certainly I find quite difficult, the kind of the imagery and the way it's constructed and the fact it's poetry and not prose, all these things are quite remote and difficult for the modern reader. But Sackville's great big long poem, was he expecting people to be able to, I mean, it was in a very popular book, was he expecting it to be quite readily accessible to the reader of the time?
Yes, he was. Sackville is working and publishing within a pretty well-established tradition. And that tradition is often kind of colloquially known as the advice to princes genre. There's a Latin term for it, the speculum principis, the mirror for princes. And there have been several compilations of the mirror for magistrates kind that had come out over the course of the 16th century. And it seems as though one of the things that Sackville got interested in when he was starting to write at the Inner Temple and he was producing his play Gorboduc with his co-playwright Thomas Norton, one of the things he gets interested in, it seems, is the ability of literature to shape political policy and political thinking. And, I mean, today this seems kind of intuitive to us, but even in the 1560s, it was a relatively new idea that literary culture might be able to shape and influence and comment upon political culture. And there were, of course, all kinds of limitations and hedging, which made sure that writers couldn't always say exactly what they wanted to say. But Sackville seems to have this clear belief that in contributing to a text like The Mirror for Magistrates, he's contributing to building the kind of political culture he wants to be a part of. And he's absolutely resolute, it seems, in his determination to craft a political culture under Elizabeth that's based on a moderate religious policy, a kind of strong diplomatic relationship with England's continental neighbours. He's economically quite conservative. And all of these things seem to him to be principles that people like Buckingham demonstrate the value of. I mean, he seems fascinated by the raw instability of Buckingham's life and Buckingham's political career. And I think it's Sackville's complaint that's one of the most interesting bits of The Mirror for Magistrates, one of the most rich literary components of The Mirror for Magistrates, not least because he takes this theme of ongoing instability, of violent and uncertain political action, and he runs with it imaginatively, much more than some of his fellow writers, particularly in that closing section, where he's describing the death of Buckingham. And Buckingham can't die, actually. This is the biggest problem he has. He keeps having to pick himself up off the floor and talk a bit more to Sackville, the narrator, about why his life has been so terrible. He keeps fainting and getting up and fainting and getting up. And it's only after about 70 lines of text that finally he's able to bid a kind of farewell to Sackville and leave Sackville with the idea that it's temperance and prudence and moderation and good judgment that will see him through. We're distrustful of these kinds of ideas maybe today, but extraordinarily, Sackville, they were the base of an entire political culture. If you could use your reason properly, then everything would hopefully fall into place.
Thank you. We'll take down there first. Thank you.
Is there a danger now, looking back, it looks all very clear what was happening to Elliot? But he had a wife who was extremely difficult. He had Pound telling him a lot of the wasteland was rubbish and needed rewriting. He did, I think, have a breakdown. I mean, was it quite the game plan as it now looks?
Well, I was exaggerating, of course, but I think it's not so much that it was a game plan as that he knew what he wanted and he knew how he didn't want to go about getting it. The difficulties of his marriage and the breakdown which is associated with that are certainly difficulties he had to overcome, which made it more likely that he would be not going to parties all the time, shall we say, and meeting lots of people. But he was all the time very protective of his output, his reputation, and who he associated with. He was very careful not to allow his work to appear in lots of places, not to write for the wrong magazines. He turned down an offer of assistant editorship of the Athenaeum, which would have paid him £500 a year, because he thought that weekly journalism might spoil his writing. He turned down, he didn't turn down, but he might have turned down, and anyway didn't get the opportunity to take up a job as literary editor of The Nation. And in each case, in the Athenaeum was edited by Middleton Murray, who was Catherine Mansfield's husband and who was a friend. The Nation was owned by Keynes, and who was trying to shoehorn Eliot into that job. And each time he stepped back and said, I don't want to do it. It's not the right thing at this point for me to do. Vivian's not well. I've got to stay in the bank. Or as Vivian said, I'm not well. You've got to stay in the bank, actually. But when the opportunity came to start the Criterion and when the opportunity came to move to Faber and Guire, then he knew exactly that that was the time to put his plan into action. So, yes, of course you're right. It wasn't all the time plain sailing, and it wasn't a career that was mapped out stage by stage, and it was more less opportunistic than self-defensive at many stages. But I think that unlike most people who rushed to be published by anybody who wanted to publish them or to do whatever people were offering, he was much more careful and had much more sense of what he might be capable of.
Considered that the weaknesses shared by Button were equally shared by the other famous people he met, you mentioned Hamilton and others. Mm. Did they all share a similar set of weaknesses?
I think fundamentally for him they did. And this, I mean, this relates nicely to Katie's question about the kind of level of awareness of what Sackville was trying to do that you might expect in Sackville's readership. And the whole point of this, I mean, this literature is really predicated in many ways on there being a shared model for understanding what constitutes a good, ethically well-lived life, that actually writing this kind of poetry will demonstrate to people, will show people the kinds of principles you should cultivate if you're in some kind of position of power. And one of the things that was, again, still relatively new and exciting in the 1560s was the notion that you could take famous people from the classical past and cast them in the same mould as more contemporary figures in order to lend weight to that argument. That there's exactly as you say, I mean, there's a direct kind of ethical line to be drawn from conflict, say, between Caesar and Pompey at the end of the 1st century BC and the Wars of the Roses in the 15th century, and that these kinds of conflicts tend to spring up because the same kinds of ethical deficiency are there in the people at the top.
I just wondered whether Buckingham had descendants who were, if he did, they were objecting through their ancestors being included in that work of fiction.
In the Mayor of Magistrates as a whole, there are several people who are written about who had prominent parts to play in the civil wars of the 15th century who do have descendants who are actually kind of there or thereabouts in the political culture of the 16th century. And it doesn't seem to be, I mean, so far as I know, and I'm not an expert on this, so I could well be wrong, but so far as I know, there's no real friction created by the mention of particular people in the Mirror for Magistrates. And Buckingham didn't have any immediate descendants who were kind of, you know, a la mode in the 1560s in Elizabethan politics. So this wasn't necessarily a problem for people who had family relationships with him. But I think there's a sense in which, because the Mirror for Magistrates casts its net really wide, and Sackville's poem is one of a couple of dozen in the collection as a whole, one of the things it's trying to say is everybody involved was responsible to some degree for the political turmoil of the last century. And similarly, if you occupy any kind of position of political authority, whatever that may be, you automatically have a responsibility to read this literature and absorb the kind of moral education it's trying to give you. So it's kind of very much one group of 15th century figures lining up against another group of 16th century figures and trying to talk to each other about their political experience. So it's a very public and corporate enterprise in that sense.
Meaning and the musicality and the rhythm of words in his poetry.
Virginia Woolf will answer you first. Eliot dined last Sunday and read his poem. He sang it and chanted it, rhythmed it. It has great beauty and force of phrase, symmetry and tensity. What connects it together, I'm not so sure. But he read till he had to rush. The Wasteland, it's called. And Mary Hutch, who has heard it read more quietly, interprets it to be Tom's autobiography. So he clearly could read it in different ways at different times. And he didn't read it aloud much after it was published. There are two recordings of him reading it later on. His readings, particularly the later reading, is extremely flat and hardly inflected. And I suspect that before it was published, when he'd just written it, and when it was in the process of being revised, he gave it a lot more welly. I think he was probably much more ready to let the poem speak emotionally than he was when it had become part of the public sphere. I think that he changed his manner of reading, and I deduce this solely from a few written accounts of him reading poems occasionally before 1925 or so. He changed his manner of reading, I think, and started to read in a much flatter and more anonymous or perhaps impersonal way.
Okay, well, if there are no further questions, then I think we can draw it to a close. As I say, the Old Library will be open for about another hour this evening, so if you haven't been to see the exhibition, then you'd be very welcome to come over now. We have the Ariel poems that Ian mentioned, the first edition of The Wasteland. I haven't checked it for ink blots, actually, so we can all go and have a look and see what quality the printing really is. And we also have the Sackville manuscript. We also have a manuscript of Geoffrey Chaucer, various other delights that I shan't go into now. Yes, I think that's it. It just remains for us to thank our speakers once again. Thank you very much.